from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Flew in from Miami Beach, BOAC. Didn't get to bed last night. On the way to paperback was on my Oh boy, the Soviet Union is gone, but the Beatles' White Album is still with us, back on the U.S. charts, cracking Billboard's top 10 for the first time since 1969, thanks to a new expansive box set that digs deep into the vault at Abbey Road Studios. It offers a treasure trove of remastered songs and previously unheard demos and outtakes. A chance to hear it all for the first time again, and to rethink everything you thought you knew about the Beatles' classic album. This hour On Point, celebrating the Beatles' White Album on its golden anniversary. Join us. Do you remember when you first heard the White Album? Is it their greatest album? Or is it a sloppy, disjointed mess created by a bunch of fevered egos that couldn't be satisfied? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook and at On Point Radio. With me in the studio is Rob Sheffield, writer and columnist for Rolling Stone. He's author of the 2017 book Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Man and the Whole World. And you can read an excerpt at onpointradio.org. Rob, great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And also with us in the studio, my old friend Tim Riley, professor of digital journalism at Emerson College. He's the author of Lennon, The Man, The Myth, The Music, and Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary. He also edits the Riley Rock Index, a collection of music commentary and news resource. Tim Riley, great to have you.
Good to see you, Anthony.
Thank you both. So I want to start with just a really general question, Rob. I'll start with you. How would you describe, and I'm talking about the original White Album, to someone who's never heard it before?
One word description would be a mess.
A mess.
It's two records, which was a very big deal back in the day when it was two vinyl records.
Right.
It's 30 songs. It's much longer, bigger, more excessive, more extreme than any other Beatle record. And all four of them going to their experimental limits.
All right. How about you, Tim?
Well, I like the way my friend Walter Everett described it. He calls it a dog's breakfast, which is, you know, it's kind of a glorious mess. And the Beatles set out to create the anti-Sgt. Pepper. So Sgt. Pepper is this very clean and very careful and elaborate psychedelic concept record. And the White Album, they get back into the studio after they've traveled to India and taken some time off, and they decide, well, let's really just shoot as far as we can in the other direction, and that's really what you get. You get sort of like the anti-Sgt. Pepper.
Interesting. So is there, Rob, is there sort of a unifying concept behind this record?
I think the concept is just they're so determined to impress each other. And
yeah,
all four of them are trying really hard to show off. Even Ringo, who finally got his first solo songwriting credit with Don't Pass Me By, a song that he'd spent 5 years writing at that point.
So during this hour, we're going to take a lot of calls. We're going to listen to a bunch of music, and I want to start doing that right now. And the thing that I love this album, I always did. What I love about this new box set is all of the demo stuff and the outtakes that a lot of us have never heard. And explain how these were recorded, where they were recorded. They're called the Esher demos. Rob?
Well, the Beatles were in India for a while, meditating and learning with the Maharishi. And they were writing a lot of songs because they had no electricity in Rishikesh, India. They had no drugs. They had nothing to amuse themselves except to write songs. As John said, we sat in the mountains eating lousy vegetarian food and writing all these songs. So they come back, they gather at George's bungalow at Esher, and they...
So that's the name of a town in England, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, got it.
And although it's spelled like Usher, which is how Americans have always pronounced it up to this point. And they just demo a bunch of songs in George's newfangled tape machine. And you can hear that they're having fun. They've got so many songs saved up. They know the songs are good. And they're really enjoying each other. They have no idea that they're going to spend 5 months making this record, driving each other insane.
All right. Well, let's listen to one of those recorded at Esher in George Harrison's house. This is Dear Prudence. Let's listen for a bit.
Come out to play. Keep the brand new day.
All right, lovely acoustic version of Dear Prudence. We're going to listen a little longer because, gentlemen, what I love about this track is in a few seconds you're going to hear the Beatles sort of bantering in a live-to-tape way. So let's listen.
Won't you come out to play? Meditation course in Rishikesh, India. Who wants to know that sooner or later she was to go completely berserk under the care of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi? All the people around were very worried about the girl because she was going insane. So we sang to her.
So what were we listening to? Tim, talk about what we were hearing.
Well,
there.
So that's Lennon, and he's just kind of trailing off into the story of how that song got written. And apparently it's about Mia Farrow's sister, whose name was Prudence. And she there was this really kind of adolescent game that got played, apparently, up at the ashram, which was, let's see who can meditate the longest. And apparently she was taking this to extremes and meditating way beyond what anyone thought was sane or normal, and they actually were kind of worried about her, and so that's how that's the source of the song. I love the rapport you can hear there. I also love how what they're doing is playing along with themselves. They each brought demo tapes and were playing the tapes live and then playing along with themselves. So you hear Lennon singing along with himself, and this is so that they could suggest harmonies and arrangement ideas on top of the basic tracks that they had. And so it's very charming to think that they had already demoed these tapes for themselves, and then they're playing these demo tapes for the other members and playing and singing along. And sometimes they're all just singing along with the demo and the author, too. And it's very cozy and intimate, and you can sense the rapport in the room.
So, Rob, you know, what strikes me about this when I listen to Tim made mention to this rapport of these four lads, and it's all over these demo and outtakes, and yet the story we always heard about the making of the White Album is that they were sort of at war, and Yoko Ono was in there messing everything up, and everyone was sort of going their different ways. But I got a sense of a band that was still having a great time together.
Yeah, that's one of the shocking things about listening to all the outtakes on the new edition is you hear these guys were having a lot of fun. That's why they spent 5 months in the studio. And there were a lot of fights, arguments. At one point, Ringo quit the band for a couple of weeks. And, you know, things are bad when even Ringo is like, I can't take this drama. You guys can have it. But we hear them laugh. We hear them sing together, even in, you know, that bit of Dear Prudence that we just heard. Their friendship is very much part of their motivation.
So tell me the story. I was reading in your wonderful book, Dreaming the Beatles, about the story of the sessions around the recording of Obladi Blada, where Paul is driving everyone batty, you write, with a song he's convinced is a hit, Obladi Oblada, which John dismisses as granny music. I think I can say crap. He uses a stronger word that I can't say on family radio. But tell this story about this, and then we'll listen to it.
So Paul has spent a week making them all play Obladi Oblada, a song they all hate, and they've really come to be sick of it. And one night, Paul announces, you know, we're just going to scrap everything we've done so far and start over from scratch. And John does not take the news well. In fact, John storms out of the studio. He comes back a few hours later in a somewhat altered state of mind. He stands at the top of the stairs and he yells, I am bloody stoned. He doesn't quite say bloody. But
right. Another word we won't say. But go ahead.
He says, I'm more stoned than you have ever been. I'm more stoned than you have ever will ever be. And this is how the song should go. And he moves over to the piano and just bangs on it, playing that intro that we all know, bum ba da dum ba da dum bum ba da, playing with that really harsh, aggressive edge. And even though he and Paul are furious at this point, Paul just hears it and says, well, that's it, actually. That is how the song should go. And so they record it, and that's the version on the album.
All right, here it is.
Running in the yard of Desmond and Molly Jones.
Obladi Oblada from the Beatles off a new box set 50 years after the original White Album came out. Listeners, does this music still resonate with you? Have you heard this new extraordinary box set marking 50 years of the White Album? Let's go to Jess. She's calling from Lakewood Ranch, Florida. Jess, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I really, truly love the White Album. I think it's just probably one of the greatest things written in the whole century. What really blows me away about it is they borrowed from every available music genre at the time for all the songs all across the album, and in the process wound up inventing two. Like, nobody had ever played as much on the crash cymbal or with that ferocity as Helter Skelter. And with Revolution Number 9, they actually, from what I hear, there was an act of industrial espionage involved, but it was the very first song that ever sampled anything, which is, you know, that has become a mainstay in music these days.
Jess, so, thanks so much for the call. We're going to sort of talk about some of the points you raised. But we're going to go out with a little bit of music. This, of course, is Blackbird. And this is from a remix on this new commemorative box set of the White Album. Listeners, we're taking your calls. What do you think? You can join the conversation. What are your favorite tracks on this album? What stands out to you? What missed the mark? Are you one of those people who thinks that maybe this wasn't such a great Beatle album? We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the light of a dark black night.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're discussing the Beatles' White Album, which is celebrating its 50th birthday this month with the release of a special 50th anniversary box set. You can join the conversation. What stands out to you on this record? Is it the best Beatles album ever or the worst? I'm talking with Emerson College journalism professor and music critic Tim Riley and Rolling Stone writer and columnist Rob Sheffield. And Rob, let me start with you as we listen to Birthday. Tell us the story about how this song came to be.
Well, one night they took a break from the sessions because somebody happened to mention that British television was showing the 50s rock and roll movie, The Girl Can't Help It, which all the Beatles had loved growing up in Liverpool. It had Little Richard performing, of course, the title song. And they all took a break from the sessions and went over to Paul's house to watch it together. And they had such a blast reliving this sort of rock and roll adolescence that they wrote Birthday that night, a sort of primal rock and roll bonding moment.
Fantastic. Tim, one of the things that I've been struck by the remastered songs on this 50th anniversary edition is just how great they sound. I'm afraid that we may not be able to give listeners a sense of that because what we're playing right now is some to mono, unfortunately. But talk about just the quality of these, the remastering of these recordings.
Right. So they've made some decisions about how to remix remix some of this. It's more than a remastering. It's all scrubbed and nicely detailed, but it's also remixed, which means they've changed the placement of some of the instruments in the stereo landscape, which is heresy, except that we don't really have any idea of what an orthodox would be with the Beatles, because we don't think that the Beatles were there for the stereo mixes. We do know that the original stereo mixes, especially starting with the White Album, were very creative and very kind of fantastical and a little bit loopy, kind of like the early Led Zeppelin stereo mixes, where you get like bass over on one side and the organ coming from somewhere else, and you get this real sense of this spatial placement of things. It's very deliberate, and yet it also is kind of lopsided in a lot of curious ways throughout the record. And they have tried to even that out here. And it sounds great, and there are purists who will complain about it. But the problem is we don't really have a strong idea of what the original intention was.
Interesting. Let's go back to the phones. Listeners, we're talking about the Beatles' White Album, the 50th anniversary of that release. Not everybody thinks it was such a great album. So let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Jim, you're on the air. Great to have you.
Hey, Anthony. In my opinion, there are a bunch of songs on this album that really were not very good. And it was composed in India, and I was wondering if you thought there was a relationship between the two. Thanks.
All right, Jim. Rob, what do you think?
Well, certainly in India, they were writing a lot of experimental songs to amuse each other and enjoy each other. I mean, that's how Rocky Raccoon came about. And there's always been the classic argument, what should it have been edited down to a single album, which, you know, the band members kept arguing about that for the rest of George's life.
Yeah. What do you think, Tim? I mean, I'm intrigued by this long debate about the White Album. We just heard there the caller from Omaha, Nebraska. A lot of people call it the best. A lot of people call it the worst. Why does it elicit these very different responses from
people? Well, because it's such a sprawling, bursting at the seams type of endeavor, right? So there is something for everybody, and there's room to proclaim it a masterpiece. And there's also room to say, you know, it's actually a flawed masterpiece. I think the way I listen to it is Lennon really is starting to peak in a new and different way, both with an experimental edge and with a return to really raw primal blues like Your Blues and I'm So Tired. And his vocals are just great all the way through. And I hear McCartney is having a couple weak songs on here. Rocky Raccoon just doesn't hold up so much.
I agree with
you.
That one never really worked for me. What about you, Rob?
I love that one. Honey Pot.
See, here we go. We've got the disagreement
that's
right
part
here.
Of the beautiful thing about the White Album is no two people would edit down the same White Album.
Yeah.
So the argument is really built into the music. The Beatles argued about what should be on the album right up to the day it was released, and they kept on arguing about it forever. Rocky Raccoon, that happens to be one I love. For some reason, Honey Pie really grates on me. That one I cannot stand.
All right. Well, here's another one that I want to play. Let's listen to Everybody's Got Something to Hide. This is from the 2018 mix on this new 50th anniversary commemorative album. Let's listen for a bit.
Come on, come on.
All right, Everybody's Got Something to Hide. Tim Riley, what do you love about that song?
Well, I think it's just a masterstroke of a kind of an updated and experimental rewrite of a tidy Chuck Berry rock and roll straight ahead number. The way USSR is to open the album, this comes near the middle of the record, and it's more like, how can we stretch this form? How can we turn it into a thousand different things and yet keep that same kind of raw driving energy? And of course, you've got that cowbell blistering away in the background there. It's feverish, and it's lively and exciting, and just it's thrilling, this song.
Let's just bring it back up for a little bit. Oh. All right, let's go to Alice. She's calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Go ahead, Alice. You're on the air, and thanks so much for the call.
Oh, hi. I'm 68, so, you know, I had the original vinyl, and my favorite songs still are USSR, Birthday, Helter Skelter, My Guitar Gently Weeps. The latter, I think, is more plaintive, but the three former, I don't have the notes right here in front of me.
Well, Alice, you've mentioned a bunch of songs that we want to talk about. And let's talk about While My Guitar Gently Weeps, because there's just a wonderful acoustic version, Tim and Rob, on this. I mean, I'm with Alice. This is one of my sort of top favorite Beatles songs of all time. And this acoustic version that we got to hear on this new album is just, I think, spellbindingly beautiful. Let's listen.
I look at you all, see the lover that's sleeping, while my guitar gently weeps. Yeah, maybe you would have to give him his own mic. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told you how to unfold your love.
So, Rob, I don't know what it is, but I don't know why George Harrison always makes me want to cry when I hear him sing. But I just love hearing that acoustic version.
It's really beautiful. And a song that really expands. You know, you can hear Paul playing the organ on this one. Something Tim mentioned a few weeks ago that I'd never noticed before is that we think of While My Guitar Gently Weeps as the guitar manifesto, but it begins with a piano solo. And it's Paul on the piano, and it's an example of how even when the Beatles were staking out their extreme individual territory, they were just innately collaborative.
Hmm. Tim, talk about this song. Are you with me that this is one of the sort of high points on the album?
I'm less of a fan of this song than a lot of people. I enjoy the guitar sounds. I think there's something just sweetly naive and heroic about how he keeps that second line in about how the floor needs sweeping. I just can't imagine that Lennon wasn't, you know, giving him trouble about that line. He's saying, George, do you really want to keep that line in? Because it just is just so weak. But
I never thought of that.
I just am embarrassed for George every time I hear that. But, you know, the thing about George in this record is that he really does come roaring through with very strong material. I think Savoy Truffle is one of the great underrated George songs anywhere, along with, like, Old Brown Shoe. And another song from these sessions that he demos at Esher, which is Sour Milk Sea, which he gives to Jackie Lomax, which is a great lost Beatle track, and it doesn't make the record. And, you know, it's one of these songs, when you do a little scholarship and you listen to a lot of bootlegs, you understand George was starting to surge as a songwriter, and I think you know, getting more space on the records than he ever had, and rightfully so.
Hmm. Rob, I want to pick up on your point about the sort of how collaborative these guys are. So let's listen to another track. This is track 7. Wait a minute. I just got confused. Good Night, right? We're going to listen to Good Night. This is take 10 with guitar from take 7 off of this 50th anniversary edition of the White Album. Let's listen to a little bit of Good Night.
Close your eyes and I'll close mine. Good night. Sleep.
I want to hear this every night before I go to bed. But I mean,
absolutely.
I love this. I love them all together here. It's amazing.
It's amazing. And it's a relatively rare treat, especially this late in the game, to hear all four Beatles singing together. And that this version was in the vaults all those years. And also you can hear, as we were talking about before, that they're having fun, that they're enjoying working together. Just the camaraderie and warmth that comes in this version is very different from how we think of the White Album.
Interesting. Yeah,
it makes me think of another theme, too, which is that the record would have ended very differently if they were all four singing together, because this record is notable because there are no vocal duets on the record. So we're starting to see Lennon and McCartney veer apart with their songwriting, and there are zero vocal duets anywhere on this record. Huh. And it's one of the key Beatle features that we look forward to every time. And on this record, they're missing completely. And one of the great vocal duets actually does get produced during these sessions, which is Hey Jude, when John joins Paul on the last verse of Hey Jude. It's a beautiful vocal duet that they do there, and it ranks among the classic Lennon and McCartney vocal duets. But nowhere else on the White Album do we have an example of that.
So why do you think that is?
Well, I think it signals how much they're growing apart. What's interesting is that the ensemble interplay is still very highly charged and very highly tuned. McCartney is turning in fantastic bass lines and energetic playing and committed playing to all of Lennon's songs, and Lennon is doing great guitar work and some vocal background work and submitting arranging ideas to songs that he's not even playing on. So the ensemble is still very rich and meaningful to them. But in terms of vocal duets, like a classical duet like If I Fell, that's just not on this record.
Let's go back to the phones. Jacob is calling from Sylvan Beach, New York. Hi, Jacob. You're on the air. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. So I just wanted to comment. I actually loved that he said it was like the anti-Sergeant Peppers because, prior to me being about 19, 20 years old, I always looked at the Beatles as kind of my mom and dad music, and then discovering the White Album, especially coming from the punk scene, it was like something I never heard. Like Happiness is a Warm Gun. And just him getting raspy and yelling so much, and I go, oh, my God, wait, this is the Beatles? This is the same band? And I just fell in love with that. Rocky Raccoon, also my favorite song. But I love the comment of it being an anti-Sergeant Pepper. It's dead on. I mean, coming from an old punk guy, it's just I fell in love with it. And then it led me to discover more of the Beatles beyond the White Album. So,
Jacob,
that's my comment on it.
So it was your gateway into the Beatles, it sounds like. Jacob, thanks so much for the call. Let's move on to Liverpool, New York, from where Vance is calling. Vance, you're on the air. Good to have you. Vince, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks. Yes, it's Vince. I'm 48 years old, and I grew up listening to it as a child. And for me, as a child, I didn't like it all that much. Today, I think it's one of the best records ever made. Some of the funny stories is my brother played Revolution 9 for us in the pitch black one night, and it opened our imaginations up. It was very spooky. I thought the poster that came with the record was up in my brother's room. That was spooky to look at. The only songs I liked as a kid was Good Night and Bungalow Bill, the fun nature behind that song. But today my favorites are Cry Baby Cry. And as you mentioned, the George songs are so great on the record. And Long, Long, Long is actually my favorite of his songs on the record. So, still love listening to it today. I played Revolution 9 for my kids, and they're pretty blown away by it, too.
Good. I'm glad you're bringing up the next generation right, Vince. Thanks so much. I appreciate the call. Tim, I actually want to ask you both, Tim and Rob, but I'll start with you, Tim. I mean, it's interesting that this album, it comes out of such a tumultuous time for the Beatles. Brian Epstein, their producer, dies a year earlier. In 1968, of course, was such a tumultuous time politically, socially. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how all of that tumult is reflected in this record?
Right. So I hear Pepper as kind of a summit, a peak where they have it's a record that makes you hear their whole career differently and as though everything was pointing towards that one moment. And that giant exclamation point of the crashing final chord of that record is also a question mark because it's very it wants to signal finality, but it signals a great giant question that kind of leaks out. It's like a leak springing out that lets the air out of the record. And I hear a kind of a secret tunnel between the chaos in those orchestral transitions of A Day in the Life straight through to the chaos and the mayhem that's alive in Revolution Number 9, as though that's kind of leaking through to this record. And it really is about how the real world is. In many ways, the Beatles were ahead of things up until Pepper, and after Pepper, at the moment that giant chord crashes down in Pepper, they kind of acknowledge that the world is kind of spinning in a way that's bigger than they can be ahead of anymore.
Interesting.
And so they're just becoming part of this larger chaos that's surrounding them. And the whole year, 1968, of course, a lot of commentators have noted what a chaotic and violent year it is. And I think that really does seep into the music. And Revolution Number 9 makes sense only in that context.
Yeah, interesting. Rob Sheffield, your thoughts on sort of how the tumultuous times around 1968 affected this record?
You can hear a lot of darkness and conflict on this record, even in a song like, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, George is singing to a world that is in a very dark place. And You can hear a lot of that all through the record. There's a lot more conflict and argument in the songs themselves than in previous Beatles songs.
Listeners, we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' landmark 1968 self-titled release. It's known as the White Album. You can join the conversation. Has the White Album grown on you over the years? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Maybe you turn the level of this mic down.
What I say is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, Julia.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're listening to new remixes and rare outtakes and demos from the Beatles' White Album, just released to mark the album's 50th anniversary earlier this month. Right now we're hearing the song Julia, one of the so-called Escher demos recorded in George Harrison's living room in May of 1968. With me, Rob Sheffield of Rolling Stone and Tim Riley, associate professor of digital journalism at Emerson College and an author, Beatles expert as well. Tim, let me start with you. This is surely one of the prettiest songs on the White Album. What do you think?
Oh, yeah.
What
so,
do you hear?
If you know Lennon's biography, you know that Julia was the name of his mother, who died in a hit-and-run accident right outside his home when he was 17 years old. So the loss in the song, something that he's been chasing through songs like Strawberry Fields Forever, and, you know, whenever he goes to the deep private place, you hear this abandonment and this bottomless sense of loss. I really like what Rob Sheffield writes about this song in his book. He pairs it with Martha, My Dear.
Huh.
And he says, I always identify with the object of Martha, My Dear. I always feel like the silly girl in that song. But whenever I hear John Lennon sing Julia, I always feel like, oh, no, I identify with the narrator.
Huh.
And I just think that's a lovely insight to how those two songs are framed and how we identify with these two narrators.
Lovely. Rob, say more about that.
Yeah, the side two begins with Martha, My Dear, which is Paul at a very Paul extreme. It's just Paul, none of the other Beatles. He's playing piano. And the album version of Julia, it's just John and his guitar. It's the only Beatles song that's just John. And you can hear that Paul and John are alone with these women, and they're both expressing their very different personalities in a totally direct and, to me, irresistible way.
We've got folks commenting on Facebook. Susan Detweiler writes, "This album displayed the true artistry of this group and, most importantly, as individuals. The pieces are so varied. I love it." And here's Marcello Fortuna, "The White Album, the most luxurious vinyl record cover." Let's go to John, who's calling from Coventry, New York. John, you're on the air. Go ahead. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for the call. In 69, I was in college, living with some guys in a big old house. And on the evening of the moon launch, a friend came over to see me, trying to sell me a bootleg copy of the White Album.
Hmm.
So I was in my room listening to the Beatles' White Album, and everybody's yelling at me to come watch the moon landing, which actually they had to pull me away from the album to get me to watch the moon landing. So I think that tells you where my priorities were.
Boy, that's a great comment about those times we were living in. They were tumultuous. They were exciting in good ways as well as unsettling ways. John, thanks so much for that memory. We really appreciate it. Let's go to Andy, who's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Andy, it's good to have you on. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. So my favorite song on that album is Glass Onion. And sure, it's not a very deep song, but it's catchy for one thing. But I like all the references to all the previous songs because it kind of gets your pull, you know, makes you think about all the different things going on in their previous albums and songs, and that's just really why I like that song.
Well, Andy, thanks so much. I appreciate that. Glass Onion, we don't have it queued up, but let's listen to something else. Let's go to I Will. This is off this 50th anniversary commemorative edition of the White Album. I Will Take 13. Here we go.
Loved you forever and
I hardly think
what
so.
Well, you know, gentlemen, I mean,
it verges from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Well, 1, 2, 3. Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I love you still.
Rob, just another great moment of these guys having fun with each other and then somehow breaking into this, you know, this great Beatles song.
Yes, and just a total example of the White Album methodology is that, you know, this Paul, very simple acoustic song that lasts, you know, barely a couple minutes, and it took them dozens and dozens of takes to do this, but, you know, they were just going for that feel. I love hearing just, you know, them crack up over that last take.
I really do. Tim, I mean, Rob mentioned dozens and dozens of takes, and they did that a lot. I mean, this is another thing that I learned listening from this and reading about it.
Right. So one of the central ironies here is how hard they worked to make it sound so offhand and slapdash.
That's
and,
so interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting, the Escher demos. The material is there. Like, there's no question. These are all really strong songs. They could make a very strong record just releasing these demos. And you get the feeling that they could always do that, that their table reads actually were that good. And then to capture that same spirit in the studio with a professional sheen takes just enormous amounts of work. And it reminds us that they were incredibly hardworking and persistent. Mm-hmm. You know, the story on this record is that they did over 100 takes of George's song Not Guilty, and then it doesn't make the record.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So that ties in with this sense of feeling like it's bursting at the seams, like it's just so, there's so much more laying around here. It's a dog's breakfast, and there's more that we're not even showing you.
Yeah, really interesting. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Bill, it's good to have you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is a really fun show. Thanks for doing it.
Sure, our pleasure.
I was a teeny bopper when the Beatles came on the Ed Sullivan Show and basically kind of got to grow up with them through my teen and young adult years, and I wanted to give your listeners, particularly ones from other generations, a sense of how culturally important this was. When the White Album came out, I was in college, and it was announced that day that they were going to play it at a coffee house on campus, and there were like 50 people sitting, listening all together for the first time to this album.
Hmm.
And I don't know if there's other examples or other artists that have been able to pull that off. I'm sure it was happening all across the country.
Bill, that's a great story. And Rob, I mean, I love the point that Bill makes up, sort of presents to us this idea that when these new Beatle albums came out, especially one like the White Album, it was sort of a cultural event that around which people assembled.
Yes, and that the records that they were always so different from the previous ones,
yeah,
which, you know, must have been just astounding. As Tim said, this being, you know, very much an anti-Sgt. Pepper, for audiences that they'd taught to hear music one way, they were refusing to repeat themselves.
Okay. I want to move on to another song because this is another one that didn't make the record. It's a George Harrison song called Sour Milk Sea. So let's listen to this. That's George Harrison singing Sour Milk Sea, which didn't make the final cut. Why not, Tim? You were there.
Well, you know, in the politics of the band, George had to vie for space on the records between, you know, the two reigning geniuses of Lennon and McCartney. So there was only so much it could contain, but he also was very committed to this young Liverpool artist, Jackie Lomax, and they were launching Apple Records. And George was producing Lomax, and he wanted to give this to Jackie Lomax and maybe save it, hold it back, to, so Lomax could have a hit with it. Huh. So that's, you see that as an act of generosity.
Interesting. And this does become a Lomax hit, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Although Lomax was, they thought he was going to be a huge star, and he never turned into much. But the Lomax version of, I think Paul McCartney plays bass on the Lomax version of that song. So as this this is the other tantalizing thing about this record. During the summer of 1968, they're not only creating the White Album, they're launching the Apple Boutique and then closing it, and then they're launching Apple Records and Films and hiring all these different artists to come and sing, and they're busy producing all these artists, and they discover James Taylor and they release Mary Hopkins, and they're being A&R people and entrepreneurs at the same time. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, we think that the ensemble stuff, when tape was rolling, they were having fun, and then the rest of the time they were starting to get into really bad business arguments.
Interesting. Wow. Let's go to Alan, who's calling from Ferrisburg, Vermont. Alan, it's good to have you. Go ahead.
Hey, hi, Anthony. Great show. I love that you're talking about my favorite album in the entire world.
Glad to hear that.
I bought that album when it first came out, and I bought it on 8-track, and it was 2 8-tracks.
Wow.
And I used to drive up in my 68 Ford Torino GT to this lonely mountain, plug it in, and listen to the entire album.
That's great.
It was
What a great way to enhance a Ford Torino GT. It sounds like a sweet ride. Alan, thanks so much for that memory. Let's get one more call. Samil is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Samil, you're on the air.
G'day, Anthony. How you doing?
Good.
First off, I just want to say I'm an Aussie living down here, and my father bought that album in 1968, the year I was born, and it's been a soundtrack to my life the whole way through. Whenever, you know, whatever's going on in my life, I've been able to reference or find solace in one of the tracks or just listen straight through to the whole album. It's a fantastic counterpoint, like you've been saying, to Sgt. Pepper's, and I've enjoyed it immensely.
Samil, thanks so much for that call. And listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about a 50th anniversary edition of the White Album, listening to a bunch of outtakes. With me is Tim Riley and Rob Sheffield. And gentlemen, I want to play a version of Let It Be, unnumbered rehearsal, which is nothing like the Let It Be that we think we all know. So let's just play this and then talk about it, because this was something that blew my mind yesterday when I heard it for the first time.
Spread words of wisdom. Let it be.
Let it be.
Let it be.
Let it be.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Malcolm comes to me. Whispering words of wisdom. Let it be.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Brother Malcolm comes to me, Rob Sheffield. So it starts with Brother Malcolm, not Mother Mary?
Very different.
What do we know about this?
Well, you know, Paul, he always said he wrote it for Aretha Franklin to sing, and Aretha Franklin did indeed record it before the Beatles did. And, you could tell he's really selling it maybe a little hard,
yes.
but it's just a beautiful version. But like you said, totally different from the solemnity of the version we know.
Right. I mean, Tim, this is what I love about these outtakes, because it gives you a little sort of window into where the Beatles are, at least where some of the music that shows up on later albums is coming from.
Right. So they're sitting on songs, and some of these songs don't make the cut for the White Album. The other thing I like about it is what a different set of clothes Let It Be has on here. They're trying so many different ways of arranging and tempos and pacing and what is going to be the best frame for this song. And it, you know, it goes on as you hear it, it's like, yeah, this isn't working. Like you're like, this is not going to be the version. And they stick with it as though, well, something might squirt out the side. We don't know. And they just go through the whole take. And there's a very long take of Helter Skelter that's like this, too. And it's very slow and it's bluesy. And it's almost like, you know, this really isn't quite working. But the more they stick with it, the more you're sort of, you know, actually, it is a little bit convincing. And so, again, we have this persistence and this commitment to creativity. We're going to try so many different ways of playing each of these songs. We're going to figure out the best one by doing like 1,000 different variations on it.
Really interesting. I think we've got time for one more call. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Danbury, Wisconsin. Steve, it's good to have you on the show. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. I think the mishmash of sounds and styles and themes on the album, it's not a weakness. I think it's the strength of the album. It's the diversity for me that has kept it fresh all these years, and I've had the album since it came out. I think nothing before it or since has had that kind of diversity and variety, and that's what makes it the great album it is. My personal favorite is Long, 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 but I love it all.
All right, Steve, thanks so much for that. I want to talk, Rob, let me just pick up one final point. Tim was talking about this sort of straight line from Sgt. Pepper's to the White Album, but in between there was Magical Mystery Tour, which seemed like a kind of unfortunate, sort of side road almost. What happened there?
Yeah, well, the main thing that happens in between the two records is Brian Epstein dies, and the chemistry between the four Beatles becomes totally different without Brian Epstein in charge. Paul sort of takes over the role of being the leader. And so the chemistry of the band is so completely different, which is, you know, makes all the difference in the world. So something like Magical Mystery Tour is the Beatles saying, okay, we don't have our, you know, the guy that we trust, we don't have Brian anymore. What are we going to do? In Magical Mystery Tour, you can hear that they're very confused and upset and sort of at their wit's end emotionally.
All right. And then comes the White Album. And Tim, do we know, I mean, are there just other treasure troves at Apple Studios of Beatle outtakes or what do we know about that? We're going to hear more of this stuff as the years roll by.
Yeah, it keeps seeping out. They'll keep, every Christmas, they're going to release a new box set. One of the things I was very disappointed about, there's a very famous, I think it's 18 minutes of Helter Skelter that gets faded back into on the version that we know. And it's apparently this long jam where they spin out and are wailing for, and that's why Ringo at the end exclaims, "I've got blisters on my fingers." He's literally, like, physically, like, depleted by the end of that. And they still haven't released that. It's very famous, but very few people have heard it. And I talked to Chris Thomas, who produced the session, and he described the session to me. There are still treasures waiting in the vaults for us to hear.
All right. Well, let's go out on Revolution One. Tim Riley, journalism professor at Emerson College, author of Tell Me Why, A Beatles Commentary, and Lennon, The Man, The Myth, The Music. Tim, thanks so much for making this such a great
hour. Thank you, Anthony.
And you too, Rob Sheffield, writer at Rolling Stone. He's author of Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Man and the Whole World. Rob, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
And listeners, thank you as well. The conversation continues at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.